Hashtag Twin Cities. Tom Osmond here on KLBB Club 1220. Tom, I think you hit the music on a little long because this is your very final flashback Twin Cities.
I think that's about where I used to do it, but, you know, Kyle does his own thing.
He does his own thing.
And I love the music. I'm sorry.
It's been, those who can't see the studio, we have not installed studio cam yet, but Tom does have a dance party every Saturday when he's here. You know, the last few Saturdays, last few months, you've been working on the daytime show with Stan, but you're here today for the final flashback Twin Cities because there's some changes in the wind for you, and you're going to be moving on to bigger and better things, but it's been a fun ride. Hopefully you'll come back for the 10-year anniversary.
You know, let's do it.
When Carson has everyone come in from the years past, and they show clips. And
well, isn't that going to be your Newsapalooza 12?
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. I'll post the set on the website 30 years from now, so you can't do it too soon.
It's Newsapalooza 12, Adrian's Revenge.
Exactly. And I have this, it is the eve of St. Patrick's Day, at least the Saturday before St. Patrick's Day, so a lot of people will be out and about celebrating the Irish. Tom, have you ever done that before?
You know, I confess I'm one of those weird people that has never gone specifically out to a bar to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Maybe I'll have some friends over, have, honestly, like, a drink, and I'll be done.
Whoa.
I know.
Spirits. But actually, I have this video. I played it last year, but I found this video of you from 2 years ago.
Uh-oh.
Let's listen to... This is Tom, Tom Shue on St. Patrick's Day.
To alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems.
Yeah! You and your friends on Saturday evening before St. Patrick's Day.
You know, I won't lie, that quote has come out a lot in my life. A lot of cheers with that.
You know, it's just, you know, when you move on here, the Simpsons quotes just don't mean the same with you being gone. We have a great show today. We have Gary Gilson. Gary Gilson is a Twin Cities journalist. I think, Gary, when you're here over half your life, whether you came from the Twin Cities or not, you become a Twin Cityan by being here.
Well, the program director at Channel 2, when I came here in 81 to work there, gave me a little trophy at the end of the first year, and it said, "You're an honorary Minnesotan."
That's right.
I come from, originally from New Jersey, but I was raised in Connecticut. But, you know, knowing about Minnesota was very important to me getting that job because I had worked here for the Minneapolis Star back in the 60s. And I visited here every year of the 17 years I was gone to New York and Los Angeles. And so I had a sense of what was happening. So when I came to audition for the job at Channel 2 in 1981, I knew something about what I was talking about, and that helped a lot.
You probably can agree with this. People that come here from other states, Minneapolis is a rare breed in the news audience because they are a sophisticated audience, and we like to think that we're a cut above the rest. But you go to some of the bigger cities, it's not the same product that it is here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and we've had award winning journalists from the Star, from the WCCO, KSTP. You're not coming into just a market just for some flash and some excitement.
No, and also the audience is very intelligent here. Time magazine sold more copies here than in most other metropolitan areas outside of the coasts because this is a place where people read.
We do that occasionally. It's a good thing. And you worked in L.A. and New York, so you're from New Jersey, from Connecticut, but you worked at WNET in public broadcasting before you came to Minneapolis.
Yeah, three different times. I was very lucky, Tom, to work with a group of men and women in New York who moved from one project to another at a particular station or from one station to another, and we were always pushing the envelope to be more experimental in the delivery of news. So the average news story when I worked at the ABC station in New York would run anywhere from 20 seconds to a minute and 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
We had stories on public television on our nightly news program that ran 6, 7, 8 minutes, and I once did a story that ran 43 minutes. And it was very exciting to work there, and we had a lot of freedom of the style of presentation. That's what I loved about public television.
Well, and the great thing was, in that era, and it would be commercial TV or in public TV, it was kind of the renaissance of video and film, and there was so much great documentaries being done in that era. There's still great documentaries now, but we'll call it the money, and I mean the effort, the energy behind documentaries from the 70s and 80s. That's where it was.
There was a documentary on Network television almost every night of the week. Not every night on NBC, but between NBC, CBS, and ABC, you could find a documentary almost any night of the week, and then add public television, and it was a smorgasbord.
Mm-hmm. And these things were not made for profit. That's the idea that news, that the news companies, the news organizations of local stations, unfortunately, now it's profit over product, I think, sometimes. And that's why on my website at tcmedianow.com, we find I get a lot of requests for these older documentaries that were made 30 years ago because they just aren't producing them anymore. Local stations don't produce their own in-house documentaries anymore.
No, because they found out that they weren't drawing enough eyeballs.
Right.
And the thing is that that those documentaries focused on really important issues that the nightly news can't cover because they don't have time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's never enough context in a daily news program that's needed for people to understand and make an intelligent decision. That's one of the drawbacks of local TV news everywhere.
You have one of these rare resumes where you were a writer for a big newspaper and you're also a producer and a host for a top market TV station. How did that? Because most people, even from your generation, either were writers or they were TV people. And with the exception of maybe Dave Nimmer and a couple others, very few had that dual talent.
Well, I tell you, when I was 12 years old, I decided I wanted to be a sports announcer. And I used to listen to the radio every night, sometimes hiding it, a little transistor radio, under my covers so that my parents wouldn't say, hey, it's time for you to go to sleep. And I listened to the best sports announcers in the country who worked in New York. I lived 90 miles from New York. And that, by osmosis, I learned how to do that without ever taking a lesson in a school.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided after I got out of the Marine Corps and worked at home broadcasting Yale basketball games that, you see, sports broadcasting was not the thing then that it is now.
No.
It's an empire now. At that time,
pre-ESPN.
Yeah, right. I remember the general manager of a radio station in my town in Connecticut, who was a friend of my family, said, hey, kid, get out of the racket. Sportscasts are a dial twister. So I listened to him. I was a young guy. He had a lot of experience. So I decided I better learn a trade.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. That's a one-year master's program. And I took broadcasting courses and other reporting and writing courses, and it was a great experience. And we graduated at the end of May, but in April I went down to NBC News. I'll never forget this, Tom. And I met a man named Sam Sharkey, who had a job, and it was a so-called informational interview.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those of us who go to take informational interviews really hope that the person who's interviewing us will find us irresistible and offer us a job. You know, it doesn't happen.
No.
Sam Sharkey's job was to be the gatekeeper to fend off guys like me
mm-hmm.
from the producer of the nightly news because they were too busy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had met a few people like this who stonewalled me. But Sam Sharkey was different. He actually said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I told him, I said, an NBC News correspondent. And this is what he said, and this is answering your question about how I got to do what I eventually did. I said, he said, we might hire you someday. You seem to have average intelligence. That's one of the most cherished moments of my life. I just love that. And he said, but we will not hire you until you work 5 years at a newspaper. Because, you see, at a newspaper, anything you write goes through 3, 4, sometimes 5 sets of eyes before it sees the light of day. That protects the public. It protects the news organization. It protects your career. It protects the people you're writing about. We don't have those resources in television. So do that and then call me in a few years and we'll see what we can talk about. Well, I went to work at the Minneapolis Star. I was a very compliant young fella, and I stayed 3 years and loved every day of it. And finally, a classmate of mine from Columbia Journalism School said, hey, there's a job at WNET in New York. You want to try for it? I got it. That's how I got into this stuff. And I talked to Sam Sharkey a few years ago. He didn't remember me, but he remembered that that's the sort of thing he used to do. I love the guy. He was living in a marina on a boat in Washington, D.C., and he was still in his 90s working for a magazine.
That's amazing. And I got to, well, one thing I want to point out here before I forget, because again, our guest is Gary Gilson, Twin Cities journalist. Sid Hartman turned 95 yesterday. Now, we've had some fun with Sid Hartman on the show. Over the years,
no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, we've had a we've tweaked Sid a few times, but one thing you cannot take away from Sid Hartman, he's 95 years old, he's still working. He's not a writer, he's a reporter, and we may not necessarily, you know, it may not be some breaking stories, but he's out there. You can't say he's not out at the games, three nights a week, at all the Vikings games, the T-Wolves games, the press conferences. And he isn't stopping anytime soon. 95 years old. There's a clip on YouTube from Night Times. I found this when I was doing preparation for our show today. It's Sid. It's from 1981. That's 35 years ago. And he's on Night Times with you.
Yeah.
Discussing Twins.
Oh, yeah. And I knew him when I worked at the Minneapolis paper. And he was a legend then. And he was a relatively young man at the time. He's one of the greatest leg men that there's ever been in any phase of the news business. He's tireless. And people love that kind of gossip, you know, that he writes about.
In those columns were as many of his detractors are reading that column as his people that enjoy reading it. And that's why his column has survived bankruptcies and restructuring and reorganizations. It's survived the test of time, and we wish Sid all the best. You came to Minneapolis in 19... What year did you come to Minneapolis?
61.
First time.
3 years at the Star, then 17 years away in New York and L.A., and then back here in 81, which was a fluke. I worked for a show in New York, based in New York, for PBS, called Inside Story with Hodding Carter, former Assistant Secretary of State for Communications. And Hodding was a newsman. His father was a courageous, liberal newspaper publisher in Greenville, Mississippi, during the Civil Rights Movement. Imagine. And Hodding, an extremely accomplished news guy, hosted this show. It was a weekly critique of American journalism, and I worked for it as a segment producer and traveled around the country doing stories. One of the stories was about the death of the Minneapolis Star as an afternoon newspaper. There was no more need for afternoon newspapers because there were no more factories, and factory workers who worked the 7 to 3 p.m. shift weren't riding home on the bus reading a newspaper because they didn't have jobs. I did this story, and as a matter of fact, Steve Cannon was a great fan of the Minneapolis Star, and I put him in a segment in somebody's house talking about their regard for the Minneapolis Star. And the camera crew I hired worked at Channel 2, and we hit it off, and they said, hey, they're looking for a host for Night Times Magazine over there. Why don't you go talk to them? That's how I got the job. And I came back here after the season in New York and moved my stuff from L.A. to Minneapolis and saw my old friends who were shifted from news to PR and had a Dixieland band, and I wound up playing the bass in the Dixieland band.
The restructuring of journalism has been going on since day one, when the radio replaced newspaper and TV replaced radio. The role at Night Times, and you came here, and the role is to produce and to host and to write this really very program that you just don't see today anymore. And by the way, I'm a fan of Almanac, and I like these shows, but we don't have a lot of just lengthy stories on Minnesota stories anymore. We have more newscasts now than we ever had before, but the stories and the content we get is so small. Now, yes, we have the internet, and we have Twitter, and we have these things to compete with. But I still long for some rarely lengthy stories. You know, occasionally we get Lost Twin Cities, or we get some longer pieces. I'm guessing you might agree with me that we still yearn for some of those longer pieces that you were doing at Night Times.
Oh, I think it would be a wise investment. It's very expensive to produce television very well. But I think it's worth the investment to do a show like Night Times Magazine, which is entirely different from Almanac. It had highly produced pieces by highly skilled young producers. I think that the stories we did had a lot of diversity. There were serious stories. I remember doing a story myself about a young man who was at St. Peter Hospital for the Criminally Insane, who had murdered his mother and tried to murder his sister. And the hospital wanted to let him out because they have an investment in convincing people that they can cure the mentally ill. And his sister tried everything she could, including going to court to try to stop it. That's a conflict of people's rights. She had a right to be safe. He had a right to be cured, but who knows if he was cured. Well, we had a story like that, and then you have lighter stories. A wonderful story that somebody did about the adoption of Korean children.
Mm-hmm.
Spectrum of stories. I'll never forget going down to St. Peter to interview this young guy. And I interviewed him, and sitting next to him is the chief administrator. He's a doctor of that hospital for the criminally insane. And he sat there, and the young guy gave his answers. And I thought the answers showed that he was well-trained in group therapy and knew what to say. And then after it was over, I went and asked the doctor if I could interview him in his office. And I said, well, if you let this guy out, how are you going to monitor him? He said, oh, he has to write a postcard to his probation officer every 2 weeks. And I didn't say it, but the audience is smart enough to recognize that in the two-week interim, he might kill his sister.
That's I always ask people, though, when you're interviewing people that have done such heinous acts, and I like to consider myself, I'm very tough and worldly, but you're sitting next to someone who took the life of someone, and you're sitting there eye to eye, and you're trying to provide a objective piece and get the facts out. There's got to be still some adrenaline and some chills on your spine when you're talking to someone in that close quarters and knowing what this person has either have the capability of doing or has done.
You know, the chills, they come in at different moments, but one of the main chills when you're interviewing somebody is when you recognize what we call the golden moment. When they say something that is so quotable and so revealing that it belongs in a time capsule. And that's what reporters crave, because quotes are the basis of most stories that are memorable. And when he said a number of times in the interview, this young man, upon deep reflection, I recognize that as the type of thing that they're taught in group therapy. And I thought that this guy is hiding something. And he was, because they didn't let him out. And he committed some other crimes while he was in the hospital. And, you know, you're looking for the revealing moment in any story. And I always, when I teach college courses, I tell my students, go out in the street, find a stranger, engage him in a conversation, win some trust, and try to dig deep. And don't come back with a story that's their resume. Come back with a glimpse of their soul. And the model for that is Studs Terkel, the great radio host from Chicago who wrote a number of books, including Working, which is about what people do all day and how they feel about what they do, to try to see what makes somebody tick. And I think that that's the other side of investigative reporting. We have to have investigations about the key issues, but the investigation of somebody's soul tells us who we live next to.
I know a common topic on Nighttimes, which you can see Nighttimes on tcmedianow.com now. You can see at least 3 episodes. We have more coming. Investigative reporting from commercial TV was a big critique on Nighttimes, at least a couple different times I've seen, which I find very interesting that the public TV station is taking to task what the commercial TV stations are doing. And I thought that was a very interesting way of some self-regulation in the TV news model.
Mm-hmm. Well, some investigations are just ratings seekers. Others are sincere efforts to draw attention to a problem that needs to be solved. Over the years, too many documentaries, not just in my opinion, but in a lot of people's opinion, were just highlighting the problem without seeking a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Geraldo Rivera, who I helped to train at Columbia in a summer program for minority groups.
So we thank you then for this.
Well, it's worse. I got him his first job at WABC-TV in New York. I used to give a talk, Tom, called I Got Geraldo Rivera His First TV News Job and Other Sins of the Media.
Right.
No, but he's very smart. Tom, I must tell you that Geraldo Rivera is exceptionally bright.
Oh, he's intelligent.
He's a lawyer. We have a mutual friend who's a great documentary producer, was the executive producer for a lot of Bill Moyer shows, and he was at a party one time with Geraldo, and we call him Jerry.
Oh, right, his name wasn't Geraldo then.
Well, yeah, he said to me that in a quiet moment, Jerry said to him he'd been promoted out of the news division to do a late-night talk show with celebrities. the beautiful people.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry said to my friend Howard, you know, Howard, I'm really troubled. I don't know whether to have friends for friends or stars for friends. So I think that's where he got off the track, because he could be doing a lot of great journalism. He's done, he did great journalism at WABC-TV in New York. He got a hospital for the mentally ill and retarded folks closed down because of mistreatment of those patients. And that was a great thing. But further, he went, I started this by telling you about solutions. He said he was tired of doing documentaries that just pointed out a problem, didn't have solutions. He formed an organization in New York called One to One, inviting citizens to build a relationship with a person who was mentally retarded. And they had a huge festival in Central Park, and there were things throughout the year, and he was looking to solutions, and I applaud him for that.
Our guest today, Gary Gilson, Twin Cities journalist. I before we go for a break, I do have to say about Geraldo. People who aren't familiar with Geraldo's full body of work can remember him for his talk show, or for him, you know, dragging people through Hurricane Katrina, or giving away battle plans in the Iraq War. But, you know, Geraldo, I think Geraldo found a way that I can profit off this journalism thing. And let's not even be journalism. Let's do talk shows. Let's do Al Capone's vault. That was a syndicated situation where he, you know, you hype, you get people that are very outrageous. You know, he was one of the forefathers of that talk show movement back in the 80s. And you look back at what he did before that, and you know, how did you go from this to that?
Well, he had a very high Q rating. You know, people mm-hmm. liked him. He's a good-looking guy. He was mm-hmm. macho. And so that syndicate hired him due to the Al Capone Vault program. And it was the highest-rated syndicated program in history to that point. Of course, when he opened the vault, there was nothing there. But the ratings were very high. So that boosted him to the next level.
And just for our audience who may not be familiar, you know, Geraldo had this big event, because I think that he had been fired from 2020 because he wanted to air some Kennedy Monroe report and Rune Auer said he couldn't do it, so he goes to do his own shows. He thought he had Al Capone's vault. He thought he had the full treasure of booty. He thought he was going to show the audience. They go up there, they open it up, and Tom, what's in the vault?
Bupkis.
Thank you. There was a broken whiskey bottle. I still remember. Because I watched this, because I was the guy watching it.
I watched it too, Tom.
So we're watching this, okay? And then remember Geraldo's like, yes, a bottle which Capone himself had drinking out of and hid here. Once he opened up, he still was insisting there was something in that.
It was live.
Mm-hmm.
He had to say something.
Let's go to a break. We'll come back with Gary Gilson here in Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB.
You know what I like? A good spicy Irishman.
Ooh, and I love a strutting Tom.
Oh, what about Reuben or Rachel?
And how about that drunken Wilbur?
But you cannot forget about that stuffed Molly Malone, because those are just a few dishes at Pub 112 that are sure to snare the senses and subdue the appetite. And of course, after dinner, enjoy a nightcap at Molly Malone's Whiskey Lounge.
And of course, an Irish pub will have all your favorite beers on tap.
So here's to a long life.
And a merry one.
A quick death.
And an easy one.
A pretty girl.
And an honest one.
A cold beer.
And another one.
Pub 112 and Stillwater.
Spring is arriving, so now is the time to sign up at CostaFarm.com for Costa Farm and Greenhouses CSA. But you may be asking, what's CSA? CSA stands for Community-Supported Agriculture. And at Costa Farms, Community-Supported Agriculture means that you purchased a share of Costa Farms' quality vegetable harvest. Just think about it, a full bushel of fresh vegetables each week for 16 weeks. Sign up at CostaFarm.com and conveniently pick up your harvest at Costa Farm and Greenhouse just east of White Bear Lake or any of a dozen locations. And these aren't just vegetables. It's fresh produce grown right here, just east of White Bear Lake at the Costa Family Farm. USDA food safety certified and GMO-free Costa Farm and Greenhouse vegetables. 3 generations and over a century of growing experience. Join Costa Farms CSA now. Simply sign up online at CostaFarm.com. And remember, quality doesn't cost a lot at Costa Farm and Greenhouse.
Hello, this is Pastor Mike Carlson from St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Matamidi, Minnesota. If you ever stubbed your toe in the dark, darkness can hurt, but we know that Jesus is the true light. We invite you to come to St. Andrew's or to listen at 9 o'clock in the morning on AM 1220 KLBB Radio. This week we'll be talking about Jesus and his power to light up the darkness. Our music will be our St. Andrew's Choir, our orchestra, and our senior high choir. See us Sunday at 9 for the broadcast, live from St. Andrews
Company Foundation on behalf of Totino's. the Twin Cities, this is Nighttimes Magazine with Gary Gilson.
Good evening. On tonight's program, we visit former Channel 5 anchorman Ron Majors in Chicago. That's where he went to work when he quit KSTP, and he talks here for the first time about why he quit. Next, another story about quitting, this time the coffee habit. Joining me in the studio will be the author of a book that tells you how and why you should kick coffee. And then it's on to the Orpheum Theater in Minneapolis for a conversation with James Earl Jones, the distinguished actor who's here this week playing Othello. I really enjoyed being with him, and I think you will, too. First, let's go to Chicago.
There we go, Nighttimes. Does it make you feel like it's 1981 again? And you're just... I love the intro, and our guest here, Gary Gilson, is typing. He's on the phone. He's got the news copy out. I love those intros.
Well, you know, what was so much fun about working on that program was not just that we had really wonderful producers and a great editor, Georgiana Day. She was the best editor I ever worked for, New York, L.A., or here. We had graphic designers that were terrific. And I loved the fact that we had time. And I wrote all the continuity introducing the other producers' programs, segments, and I got to do my own segments. What could be better? That's the best job I ever had.
It looks like a good job, and the best part, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just by watching video from across the country, we here in Minneapolis-St. Paul, we had a great public TV station. I mean, we still do. This was not what, if you went to smaller markets or even some of our moderate-sized markets, they weren't putting the amount of effort and innovation in their public TV station that we did here in Minnesota.
Well, you know, they didn't have the money, Tom. There's plenty of money here, and the people who raised money for Channel 2 had the advantage, besides their ability to raise money, they had the advantage of the resources of all these Fortune 500 companies that were here. So that makes a big difference. Now, I was telling you before about the spectrum of stories, you know, that criminally insane guy. I just remembered a story that a woman named Deanna Camille did for us. She went to a small town. We always wanted to go out to reflect life in Minnesota outside the metro. And she started it with shots of clotheslines in backyards of this small town, and there were baseball jerseys hanging on them, drying. And the voiceover was the announcer from the local baseball field, and here's what he said: starting at shortstop, number 15, Gunderson; at first base, number 7, Gunderson, and it went on and on, and the whole team was the Gunderson family. And she visualized that, and it was wonderful. And then she cut from the backyards to the ball field. Well, she's really a terrific filmmaker. Mm-hmm. It was fun to write an intro to that.
That's great stuff. And Nighttimes lasted through 87 or so?
Let me think. I think maybe 85.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that was the year I did documentaries on Vietnam veterans, and those were in Nighttimes, yeah.
And many of us will remember you from those many pledge drives you did over the years. So a lot of our audience will remember Gary Gilson, not only from Nighttimes, but from asking us for money for a few times a year, which now seems like it's every week now. But that was...
Well, I did it a few times, but the one who should have his face on Mount Rushmore is a lawyer named Paul Hanna. He's the one who has done it for years and years and years.
I always love also the three rows of phones, the people on the phone the whole time. They're just, I'm guessing, in the middle of stage sometimes once in a while, the phone calls. But we'll assume not, right? Okay. So the question you asked before the show started was, am I going to ask you what you're up to now? And of course I'm going to ask you what you're up to now. You were teaching at my alma mater, St. Thomas, a little bit. And what else are you
doing?
Yeah,
I taught at St. Thomas three or four times over the years. But my main commitment has been at Colorado College in Colorado Springs, a small liberal arts college, 2,000 students. The unique thing about it is that the students take one course at a time for 3.5 weeks. I own them. My course is called Politics, Ethics, and Journalism. This year I had 10 students. They were the best ones I ever had. Marvelous experience. None of them wanted to be a journalist. They all wanted to do different things. But what I liked so much about the fact of teaching this course is that they were all very smart, but they were also very good people. And I got to know them very well because I had one-on-ones with them every other day going over their papers, etc. But something very interesting happened. You know, you prepare a course months in advance. Who could prepare a syllabus that said, Brian Williams is going to have a meltdown? It happened in the middle of the course. Can you imagine how rich that discussion was? But here's the thing. I said to them, how many of you, the 10, ever heard of Brian Williams? 1 out of 10 heard of Brian Williams, which I wasn't surprised about because these kids, their generation, doesn't watch the nightly network news. When I was a young fella, 92% of the television viewing audience watched a nightly newscast. Now it must be under 30%. So then I asked them, how many of you have ever heard of Allison Williams, his daughter, who was one of the stars of the series Girls? And none of them said they had heard of Allison Williams. I was shocked because that program is supposed to appeal to them. But anyway, we had great discussions about the Brian Williams case, and my students fell in love with David Carr, who wrote about that.
I was just going to actually ask you about this because David Carr, who we discussed a couple weeks ago, his unfortunate passing. David Carr was a guy that you talked a little about getting into the soul of someone, walking on the street and talking to someone. David Carr, just from his own background and his own style, when you read David Carr's work, you knew that he not only knew what you did, what you were, the resume part, but he knew what you were all about. And that's where David Carr got his stories from, at the Twin Cities Reader, and of course he did some magazines, eventually New York Times. David Carr also was able to go in the, we'll call it the celebrity pretty people world, be able to talk to them, but he's also able to come back and he, in his book and his reflections, he knew where he came from. And I had to ask you, that's the kind of journalist I think that is so successful, and it's so unfortunate that David Carr and his like are gone. My point of bringing him up before was, with your journalism students, I think David Carr could get frustrated with journalism students or people that came up to him who he didn't think did the legwork. He didn't think they did the boots on the ground. And this is based on his close friends, Brian Lambert, a former friend of ours, talking to him and reading all the tributes to him. Was David could be, you know, he could be a little bit curmudgeonly in his later years because what he saw was a kind of an errand journalism where people were trying to be journalists from a computer and not going out there and not getting stories.
Yeah, well, he's in the tradition of Jimmy Breslin and Pete Hamill and Murray Kempton, the great shoe leather reporters. And I knew David Carr, and I communicated with him a number of times over the years. And what I loved about him is not only did he know what he was talking about, because he'd done the legwork, and he knew the sources, he didn't sit still for any BS. If anybody who's listening has not seen the documentary, Page One, Inside the New York Times, you owe it to yourself to see it. And there's a great scene in there where David Carr, who wrote a great story about the disintegration of the Chicago Tribune Company, has the lawyer for the Chicago Tribune Company on the phone who's trying to grease him and stall him. And David says, the wonderful scene, he said, look, it's really nice having a conversation with you, but we're doing a story tomorrow. I need you to say something hard. So that's David Carr. And he was a great guy and a very intuitive, and I loved his writing. He was very irreverent, and he had the way to turn a phrase, and I value that very highly.
And it's just an unfortunate, too soon passing. Back to Brian Williams real quick. I don't follow the Twitter as much. I'm very media connected, but I go 4 days. I feel like I've missed a month of the world. The Brian Williams thing, and I don't watch nightly network news very often. First of all, I know the news stories before they say it. I don't need to watch TV to do it right now. But especially the ones they do on network news, it's all saturated, cut up. It's a very small portion of what we've already been reading about all day. The Brian Williams story. Why are people surprised? I read this and thought, why are we surprised that he's embellishing a little bit about this and he's making up stories? First of all, he's reporting on politicians who do this all the time. He likes going on comedy shows, The Tonight Show, The Daily Show. Why are we surprised? We've blurred journalism and entertainment so much, especially in network TV. Why are we surprised about this?
Well, I was surprised because the people that over the years that I've respected who have that job, Walter Cronkite, Frank McGee, John Chancellor, even Scott Pelley, I don't think they would ever do that. But, you know, Brian Williams has a talent that most of them didn't have. He's got a highly developed sense of humor and irreverence and made him a desirable guest on the late night talk shows. And he grooved on that and he went on with Jimmy Fallon and did a rap thing. The other guys don't do that. So right. I think it's probably easy to get seduced into thinking that that's who you are. But that's not what your responsibility is. It's tragic, I think.
No, and I agree with you on that. And the reason why, and by the way, I'm surprised that he... he did it. I'm not surprised it happened, because what you're absolutely right. When you think of the news anchors, we'll even go, let's take Rather and Brokaw and those guys. They weren't doing comedy bits on the late night shows. They'd come on and talk about some serious events, but they weren't doing comedy. Brian Williams at one point said he'd rather be on the Tonight Show than the nightly news. And that right there should be a sign for all of us that we're blurring some lines here. Also, Brian Williams, from what I understand, and this is maybe a little bit gossipy here, but he liked being the center of attention. I think that when you go on these talk shows and you have people that are laughing at you and applauding you, and you go to your social circles in New York, you got to keep up that audience. You got to keep up that mystique to you. You got to keep impressing people, because all of a sudden you become just a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
what are you then?
Well, I didn't know all the things that you knew, so I'm not surprised that you're not surprised.
And, well, you know what? Now, that's it is unfortunate. But I my point was, I didn't realize it was a story. All of a sudden, people with Brian Williams, he's the worst thing now to journalism. And I'm like, what happened? All of a sudden, everything he said in the last 10 years was embellished. And the fact checkers came, that which weren't there a year ago or 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
Well, you know, when you talk about nightly network news, there's something that's changed about it. And there are a lot of critics who have recognized this. There's a lot more fluff in a nightly network newscast than there used to be. Because of the diminishing audience, they're trying to hold on to them and trying to appeal to different interests. My wife and I watch the news, and we both have the same reaction, local news and network news. They will do a significant story and leave unanswered critical questions. And I think that goes back to Sam Sharkey when he said to me that 3, 4, or 5 sets of eyes will see your story before mm-hmm. it gets in the newspaper. There are fewer people in the editing level and throughout the news business today, not only in television, but in newspapers. Stuff I've read stories in newspapers. I read a story in the paper about some project in Dinkytown. And here's this big story about a big development. The neighbor never tell you where it is. And that's not unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because there aren't copy editors anymore. They're where they used to be. And so this is a challenge for the news business to provide not only context, but basic data that grounds you as a reader or as a viewer.
You're teaching young people right now. What do you think? You've taught over multiple different generations. We'll call it generations. And I think even 5 years ago to now is a different generation.
20 years at Colorado College.
What do you think is the biggest change in students right now that you're seeing than it was 20 years ago?
Well, first of all, they used to read newspapers, and they don't now. I told them, get your news anywhere you can get it, but come in prepared to spark a discussion that's going to produce some real engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're forced to read look at the New York Times. When they get their news from Facebook and Twitter and other places, it doesn't have the context. So there's a difference in the quality of the discussion. However, these kids are really smart. And they have some insights that make it possible for them to have a good discussion. The problem in the whole business is that if newspapers go away, if the papers that now spend a lot of money developing stories go away, then the social media will not have stories to pass along, to aggregate. Who's going to invest in getting the stories that we need to know? And those are the stories that we grew up getting because there were huge investments in them. And those investments, that's not what these websites do. They aggregate other people's news.
There's more reporters now than ever, reporters, but not paid or trained reporters. That's the challenge I think we run into. And unfortunately, we've seen how many times we've seen our local news stations, not so much in Minneapolis, but for example, in San Francisco, when they had a plane that went down the runway, and someone fed a news station names of people that were impacted by this, and they're all made-up names. They're mm-hmm. all actually, they're all racially humored names. And someone, again, you talk about the five set of eyes. Someone took these words, didn't comprehend to type them in to a Chrome or a Chiron or whatever they're using. They read it on air. Where was the fact checking in all this? Everyone's a reporter, and I think that there's some great things by having citizen journalists, because everyone has video camera. Everyone has the ability to report now, whether it be Twitter or Facebook or social media or their own website or blog. So politicians are going to have a harder time doing things that are corrupt. People are going to have a tougher time saying one thing to you and then saying something else to someone else and being able to play both sides of any story, any idea. But where we get our information, how we become better news consumers, and how we figure all this out, that's going to be the big challenge. Well, it's a challenge we have right now. That's going to be, especially if the big major newspapers decide to go more citizen journalism route. They have bloggers on staff now. I think they pay them probably a little bit to have their blog up. They have people out in the field doing things. We still need some paid journalists to be out there to actually get some facts and get some context to a story.
What you need is discipline, and you need a sense of history. Papers that buy out reporters who've been around for a long time, they're losing the connection with people who have a sense of the history. When I teach courses, I say there are two major things I say to the kids. The key element of journalism is verification. And the way I put it is, do we know this? And that means fact-checking.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know this? Otherwise, we're not going to go with it. The other one is GOYA/KOD. Get off your ass and knock on doors. And that's what David Carr was so upset about. Mm-hmm. Too many people being reporters through the computer instead of going and knocking on doors.
Right. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with Gary Gilson, Twin Cities journalist, and we have some more hard-hitting questions for Gary after this break on Flashback Twin Cities on KLDB.
Wendy's presents Red in the Wishing Well.
What's that, boy? Joey's trapped in a wishing well? He jumped into the well? Why? To grab enough coins for some natural cut fries to dip in a Frosty. Oh, wow, I'm going to Wendy's. Oh, don't worry. Joey will be there when I get back.
Wendy's hot, crispy, natural cut sea salt fries and a cool, creamy Frosty, just 99 cents each. It'll change the way you see change.
Now that's better.
Prices and participation may vary.
As their menu says, life is uncertain. Best to eat dessert first. At Sail Away Cafe, their desserts are so unbelievably delicious, you'll want to start with dessert. Gooey butter cake, chocolate ganache cake, homemade cheesecake, or key lime pie, to name a few favorites. But save room for some delicious homemade soup, homemade pizza, or dinner of pasta Adriatica. You'll be glad you did. Sail Away Cafe is fine dining with a hometown feel. So gather up your friends and meet at the Sail Away Cafe in Afton for dessert, breakfast, lunch, dinner, or live music on the weekends. Destination, Sail Away Cafe. Fan Afton.
Club 1220 KLBB presents the Community Calendar. The American Red Cross is holding a blood drive today at Marcus Cinema in Oakdale. The comedy The Foreigner is on stage this weekend at the Lakeshore Players Theater in White Bear Lake. For tickets, visit lakeshoreplayers.com. Tickets are on sale for the Phipps Oratorio Society's performance of Mozart's Requiem on March 29th. Visit thephipps.org for more information. The City of Lakes Chorus performs Singin' with a Swing tonight at the University of Northwestern's Maranatha Hall in Roseville. For ticket information, call 651-631-3768. The Washington County Historical Society is holding an informational meeting on becoming a volunteer this Sunday at the Warden's House Museum in Stillwater. For more information, call 651-439-5956. If you have an item for the community calendar, you can send it to me, Jeff, at klbbradio.com.
Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond. Got a few questions left for you, Gary, before I lead you out of here. One is, you stayed in Minnesota. You've had the chance to go back to the coasts, and you stayed here. What kept you here?
Well, I had good jobs. That job at Channel 2 was marvelous. Then when they ran out of money, I went to Channel 4 and produced some programs there. Great station, great tradition. And then I was a member of the Minnesota News Council, a voting member. There were 12 journalists and 12 non-journalists listening to complaints against news outlets. And then I became the director of that for 14 years. And it was a nonprofit, and I think we had a real impact in helping the news media gain trust at a time that they were losing it. Because if a news organization has the enlightened attitude of making themselves vulnerable, then they win trust. It's when they stonewall that they lose trust. So I did that for 14 years. Besides, Minneapolis is a very seductive place. You know, you go other places and it's a hassle to travel, and it's a hassle when you get there. You get back here and 15 minutes from the airport, you're home and you're surrounded by beauty. And it's marvelous. So why leave?
I tell some young impressionable people sometimes, I want to live in Chicago. It'll be, yeah, when you live there, you're going to take an hour and a half just to go to the grocery store. You're gonna miss going, you know, getting on Highway 36 and being somewhere in 10 yeah. minutes. You were in Detroit recently. I want to hear about this story.
Yeah, well, I read the paper about a year and a half ago, and I read that there was going to be a Detroit documentary film festival sponsored by the Detroit Free Press newspaper. All documentaries about Detroit to raise the city spirits. They're in the doldrums. It's worse than the doldrums. And I made a documentary after the uprising in Detroit in 1967, which was on public television in March of 69. I wrote to the woman who was coordinating the film festival. I said, I have this film. Do you want to see it? She said, sure, send it. So I sent her a DVD, and I didn't hear anything for a long time. And then she called me up, and she said, we're featuring your film in our festival. Will you come down on our dime? And we'll put you up in a hotel, and you'll be on the panel after the film. And I said, of course. So I went down in a beautiful Art Deco theater attached to the Detroit Institute of Art. 850 people came to this screening. Many had not been born during the 67 uprising. Some lived through it. They were knocked out by the film. It's the only time it had been shown in its entirety in all those years. And then it was a great discussion afterward. And it was a tremendous thrill for me to see people moved by what they saw. And I hadn't looked at it in many, many years. And there's some really important things in there about race relations, which is something I concentrated on during my career. So that was a wonderful experience. You asked me what I've been doing besides teaching. I conduct workshops in the craft of clear writing. When I was 12 years old, Tom, my uncle, my great uncle, Ollie, got me a subscription to the New Yorker magazine. That's very rich stuff for a 12-year-old. I fell in love with language. I made my living as a communicator and as a storyteller. And somebody said to me, do you look for errors in the stuff you read? Is it an onerous experience? I said, no, I don't look for errors. They leap off the page. And I even wrote to the New Yorker last week. They had two errors in the same story. And I wrote to them, and they've written back, and they acknowledge the errors, but there were never any errors in the New Yorker. Even no. They are suffering from the cutback in copy editing. I do these workshops at companies and nonprofits to help people write clearly. And there's my mantra is, make what you write, say what you mean. And then the best piece of advice I've ever seen about writing, there's advice from Stephen King and Elmore Leonard and all these wonderful writers. Mark Twain has great advice. But the best piece comes from a guy who lived from 35 A.D. to 100 A.D., Marcus Quintilianus. And he said, we should write not so that it is possible for the reader to understand us, but so that it is impossible for the reader to misunderstand us.
That's wonderful.
And that's what I try to get across. And I do it anecdotally so that it's memorable and engaging. And I love doing it.
That's wonderful. You can't see yourself ever stop doing this, I assume, right? You
can't. Oh, why stop? I mean, this is like, it's like a heroin addict, doing it with words.
No, that's wonderful. And by the way, that Detroit documentary, that's something some people can see? Is it?
No, they can't see it unless you put it up on your website.
That might happen. TCMediaNow.com. If you want to see Gary Gilson's work on Nighttimes, and we're going to have some more of Gary Gilson's work on TCMediaNow.com, so please go there and see it. If you want to see Gary, there's some great video. There's a piece with James Earl Jones, and James Earl Jones, before he was the superstar he is today, he was doing Othello at the Orpheum. And yes, he'd done Darth Vader, but he... the fact that you were able to talk with James Earl Jones, this is some rare video that he's doing, a local you know, 14th Market show in St. Paul, or Minneapolis, and here you are talking to James Earl Jones.
Yes, of course. It was great to talk to him because he has this great presence and this great voice. And, you know, he's a stutterer, but he doesn't stutter when he says other people's words. And I asked him a question about Othello's tragic flaw. And James Earl Jones was known at the time for the leading portrayer of Othello. And he looked like he'd been hit between the eyes with a baseball bat. He said, tragic flaw? Here he's been playing this part for decades, and he didn't know that Othello had a tragic flaw.
Just a minor one. I saw it at the Guthrie last year. And I was looking to get tickets to be almost front row. In the new Guthrie Theater, it's a very interesting setup, and it's a bit too intense to be front row at Othello, let me tell everyone. Gary, I appreciate you being here, and by the way, you're going to be part of Newsapalooza on May 7th, and I have not announced this yet on the air, so Newsapalooza 2, Tom, you're going to be there.
Oh, you bet.
With working microphones.
Hey, Tom, can I tell you my website address?
Please.
www.writebetterwithgary.com.
writebetterwithgary.com. We'll post that to the Facebook page today, too, on Flashback Twin Cities. Newsapalooza 2, another evening of history and humor. We'll have some video. We'll have some commentary. We'll have some questions and answers with our own Stan Turner, Gary Gilson, and some other panelists, which will be TBD, because they're such a great panelist here. I don't want to give it away just quite yet. Tickets, now get this. You think this would cost how much, Tom?
Oh, gosh, $20? $25, $30, somewhere around there.
I was hoping you'd say a couple hundred, but no.
Several thousand dollars.
$15 gets you admission at the Heights Theater. It's going to be a balmy, warm May 7th, a Thursday night at the Heights Theater. We were doing a balmy, cold 20 below night last year.
I was going to say, you remember the drive-in last year?
I do recall that last year.
I was amazed. The people who came, they really wanted to be there because they went through some pretty awful weather, and they loved it.
Last year, Gary, we did it on a 20 below day. Last year, we had a lot of people at Newsapalooza. It is a fundraiser for TCMedianow.com, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. Been able to preserve video and film and everything else of our local area, so I hope to see people there. You can get tickets at TCMedianow.com. We have a link to get tickets, or TCMedianow.brownpapertickets.com. $15.
And your videos from last year were just hysterical. The time capsules of the 70s, early 80s, you can't write that anymore.
The pressure is, Tom, is I have to find video even funnier, but you know what?
You better.
I might have found a few pieces which might be funnier.
Outstanding.
Well, Gary, we will have you on again. This is a great show. Again, what's writewithgary.com?
Writebetterwithgary.com.
Writebetterwithgary.com.
Thank you for inviting me, and thanks to our mutual friend Brian Lambert for introducing me and you to each other.
I appreciate that. We'll be back next Saturday here on Flashback Twin Cities on KLDV. Tom, this is it.
Adios, fellas. It's been a great time.
We'll see you.